Welcome to the AFP Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Thursday, March 10th, 2022. This is the third edition of the AFP Report, a new podcast series where I will be interviewing reporters and contributors to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper. Today, I am joined once again by Mark Anderson, an independent investigator and longtime reporter for American Free Press. All right, Mark Anderson, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
Great to be with you again, John.
Yeah, good. This is 2 weeks in a row now, so hopefully we can make this a habit. It's, you know, it's good catching up and talking about some of the stories in American Free Press, some of the topics that you're writing about, some of the topics that I'm writing about. And I wanted to start off by discussing an issue that you've been covering very, very well for the paper, and that is the issue of voter fraud. And this is a topic that AFP has been covering for a long time. And in the most recent issue of the newspaper, you actually interviewed a representative from an organization down in Georgia called Voters for Trusted Election Results. I believe their website, if you just go to voterga.org, that'll take you right to their website. Can you tell us a little bit about this organization and what they've been up to and sort of what they've uncovered?
Oh, yeah, there's a great deal to say here. I want to start out by saying that this investigation, this probe by Voter GA, is by far the most enduring, productive, successful investigation into the November 2020 elections of any of the states. There really is no comparison. Garland Favrito, it's an Italian name, he's an IT guy himself. He is mainly the spokesman, the main spokesman for Voter GA. As you say, it's Voters Organized for Trusted Election Results. GA is in Georgia.org, voterga.org, a really clever name. And it's just amazing the resilience and the stick-to-itiveness, you might say, that this group has. That being said, they have uncovered a mind-boggling array of irregularities, fraud, and not only have they investigated and found a lot of things, but they have uncovered things that call for even more investigation. It's like somebody digging that can't seem to find the bottom, and they have to keep digging and digging, and more artifacts keep coming up in the excavation, if you follow my metaphor.
Yeah, and, no, I can imagine. There's, well, you know, and that's the thing. There have been reports from all over the country of, you know, all sorts of irregularities and just outright fraud in the past election. And, you know, this is something that comes up in every election, I think. But the sheer scale and the brazenness in this past election is really quite astonishing.
Oh, it is. Yeah. And, of course, it makes you wonder about all the motives surrounding and coming from COVID-19. As we know, the illicit and extremely irresponsible and astronomically inflated use of mail-in ballots just went off the page, just off the scale altogether because of this claim that people couldn't get together at physical balloting sites and voting sites. Therefore, we had to have mail-in ballots way beyond the normal conservative threshold used for traditional absentee ballots. I'm a former election worker myself from Michigan. I worked for a year up in Pawpaw Township, Michigan, and I was trained in elections right as electronic voting machines were really coming to the fore. And I used to work the qualified voter file there, and it was extremely important in that voter registration base to take out the dead people, put in the people that moved into that jurisdiction who are eligible to vote, and then take out those that moved out of that jurisdiction because they're going to vote elsewhere and live elsewhere. And my job every day that I worked was to make sure that file was up to date. And that's just the most basic fundamentals there. And my most recent story in American Free Press, that's sort of the launch pad for today, the headline in the March 7 and 14 issue 11 and 12 of 2022, is Election Integrity Group Pressures Georgia, subhead, Watchdog Organization Concerned About Security of Voter Registration Data. And get this, the first paragraph spells it out. While Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger basks in the glow of his recently released book, Integrity Counts, I might say it's an ironically named book, the nonpartisan election integrity group Voters Organized for Trusted Election Results in Georgia contends that Raffensperger's efforts to effectively, get this, privatize the Georgia voter registration system by outsourcing it to an online cloud-based platform is fraught with peril. I mean, this is absolutely outrageous, John, that yes, Raffensperger yep. is intent on turning over the voter registration data to a company that is embroiled in a lawsuit. They're a defendant in a class action lawsuit, and this turnover could happen by March 15. As we speak today, it's March 10 of 2022. 5 days from now, as we record this podcast, Voter GA is trying to stop that from happening. And here, Raffensperger is going around talking and giving talks and speeches about his book, Integrity Counts. Really, George? I mean, really, Brad?
You know? Yeah, it's like the exact opposite. It's total gaslighting. And, you know, that's been a major theme this entire time with this election. I mean, think about it. They were telling everybody, and they continue to tell the public, that Joe Biden received, what were the final totals? 81 million votes, I think, the most in any election in history. It's just, I mean, who actually believes that? Is there anybody that genuinely buys that? It's just an outrageous claim to make, and there's just no way it's even close to reality.
I can't imagine what kind of mental framework it would require to believe that, hands down. It's beyond my imagination. But to read on just a little bit more to paint a even clearer picture of this, and this is just the tip of the proverbial iceberg, the Secretary of State, that's Raffensperger's office, selected a platform known as Salesforce. That's one word, Salesforce, in conjunction with a lesser-known company called MTX as the implementation partner in what Voter GA co-founder and IT specialist Garland Favrito describes as a, quote, secret no-bid contract that has been well underway for some time. Again, a secret no-bid contract, important words. And Favrito added, quote, the initiative would move the voter registration system outside of Raffensperger's control, where it is vulnerable to a variety of cyber attacks and left in the hands of third-party vendors whose employees are not sworn to uphold the Georgia Constitution.
And, one question. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to ask really quick.
Okay, go ahead.
One thing that I am just confused about. Why do these, and this is happening in other states as well, in other jurisdictions, from what I understand, this sort of like the privatization of the election process itself. How are they justifying this? Why can't we do this the old-fashioned way that we've always done, where there's checks and balances and safeguards in place? Why the need to sort of privatize all these efforts?
Well, that's a very good question. Part of it is the mindset of the pseudo-conservative view of the free market. There are some Republicans and libertarians that have this view that the free market is self-correcting. And you have to wonder what they mean by the words free market. It's kind of like the Rockefellerian definition of free trade. You hear the word free and you think, oh, that's good, right? Liberty, freedom, free trade. Well, that's not what they mean by free trade. They mean free from public scrutiny, free from the hands of justice, beyond the reach of the law, unaccountable trade policies. That's what free means, okay, to the globalists. Now, the free market, wink, wink, nod, nod, is kind of the same thing. It doesn't mean liberty or free in the sense that you and I, John, think of those words. It means basically free from scrutiny, free from necessary regulation. You know, regulation isn't always bad. There is such a thing as tolerable common sense regulations, things that are needed to instill the checks and balances that you're talking about. The idea that everything can run laissez-faire with absolutely no regulation is a heresy, actually. And a populist view, which AFP is basically a populist paper, recognizes that there's a degree, there's some regulation that's necessary for society to be publicly oriented and accountable. Yes, you don't want too many regulations. You don't want it to be where regulation becomes strangulation, of course. But what you find is regulations tend to land on the small businessman, and the mattoids and the plutocrats and the big movers and the shakers tend to emerge rather unscathed. So they write the regulations in such a way where it doesn't really come down on the rich and the super rich. They did the same thing when they passed the income tax in 1913 as the 16th Amendment. They told everybody, we're going to get those robber barons. Oh, the rich are going to pay their fair share. Oh, no, they're not. They already created the tax-exempt foundation, moved their money off the regular tax table, you might say, and tucked it away into tax-exempt foundations, these huge tax shelters. And so basically they had a trap door, an escape hatch for the tax that they imposed on the middle and lower classes. So once again, we're going to get those rich people. We're going to have free trade. We're going to have free markets. Now, what I just said has to be said to kind of lay the context. So part of it is this ideology of free markets. Oh, if you privatize things out, if you contract out, if you farm things out, you're going to get more bang for your buck. But, however, you're also giving it to companies whose backgrounds, number one, could be checkered, like the checkered past and the very questionable present activities and lawsuits surrounding Salesforce that I just mentioned. Number two, you have cronyism. You have people in the private sector whose companies get no bid contracts. So the natural question here is, who in Salesforce might be a friend of Brad Raffensperger, right? And so, right. And but here's the thing, John, these things used to be the meat and potatoes of regular journalism. It used to be a perfectly natural thing that a reporter, let's say for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the main daily in greater Georgia, would look at Salesforce, look at what Raffensperger, the Secretary of State's doing, and naturally inquire, Salesforce got a no-bid contract. And then the natural question to ask is, who in that office, the Secretary of State, up to and including Raffensperger himself, might have a college buddy in Salesforce, might have an ex-girlfriend, a mistress. I mean, who knows? All of that used to be just, you know, meat and potatoes, regular investigative journalism. Now, if you even raise these simple questions, you're a conspiracy theorist, and the media goes after truth seekers rather than being a truth seeker itself.
And right. Yeah,
there you have it. I mean, that's sort of the philosophical milieu into which this is happening.
Right. Well, and you know, it doesn't take much digging to discover that Salesforce is a very shady company. It's founded by this guy, Mark Benioff, who mm-hmm. was deeply tied to Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016. Doesn't he also own Time?
I did not look that part up. The other part about his political leanings, I confirmed that myself. Indeed, it says in this article, Salesforce is based on Amazon Web Services, which deplatformed the conservative social media platform Parler, just as it gained significant market share and became a threat to larger social media platforms, Favorito noted, adding that Salesforce and its president, Mark Benioff, are, quote, political partisans who publicly opposed election integrity initiatives, including Senate Bill 202, a state bill that made ballot images public record so election results could be better verified. And so Raffensperger goes on to spell out that Salesforce is politically compromised and politically biased. They're not a neutral party. How can you give the voter registration data via the cloud? And the mystery of the cloud is, you could do a whole show on that. What is the cloud? Where is the cloud? Someone direct me to the cloud, right? And I don't save anything on something called the cloud. I don't know about you, John, but it ain't going to happen. And right. they're increasingly trying to make computers into passive instruments where we store our stuff, our own data, our own personal data outside our own computers and tablets. And people have got to stop falling for that trend. That being said, so you have Salesforce getting a no-bid contract. You have Salesforce in a lawsuit where they had, let me see, the malware acquired. Let me back up. Salesforce is the target of a class action lawsuit amid allegations that its Commerce Cloud became infected with malware. The malware acquired personal identification information for nearly 20,000 of Salesforce's customers, Favorito said at a recent press conference, which also was noted in a subsequent VA Voter GA press release. Quote, it was later found for sale on the dark web, a list of PID, personal identification information on 20,000 customers, was later found for sale on the dark web. I'm repeating that. The suit that Salesforce is involved in as a defendant further alleges that Salesforce did not release a vulnerabilities and exposures report, nor did it make any notifications of that breach of 20,000 customers, that is. So you've got, again, to repeat, they're a no-bid contract. They're on the brink of getting the contract by March 15. And in this lawsuit where they're a defendant, it's alleged with quite a bit of convincing information that 20,000 customers of Salesforce, the personal identification information on them was breached, and then they're politically biased in favor of the Democratic machine. Could you think of a worse organization to give the voter registration data of Georgia, John?
Well, right, exactly. That's exactly what I'm thinking. And by the way, I just actually looked up Mark Benioff just on Wikipedia. Yeah, he actually does own Time Magazine.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, he's the founder and CEO of Salesforce, which is this company that you're referring to. I should point out, Time Magazine released that article. I can't remember the author's name. I just pulled it up here, and it's behind their paywall, so I can't access it. But I'm sure you're familiar with it. It came out, I think it's been a couple years now. I want to say like the fall of 2021. But it was the secret bipartisan campaign that saved the 2020 election. And it was an incredibly revealing article that basically outlined and described how the election was essentially stolen from Trump through this American version of a color revolution. And it was presented as quote unquote, like securing democracy and, that sort of way. So it's very interesting. So anyways, I just bring that up because this guy, Mark Benioff, owns Time Magazine, and they're, openly reporting and documenting how they basically engaged in this huge conspiracy to steal the election. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, so I remember seeing that, and help me understand the nature of that document, that report, whatever you want to call it. It's a tacit admission, correct?
Basically, there were some incredibly revealing quotes from it. I'm looking at the article right here, but I can't read it because it's, like I said, it's behind a paywall. But basically, it described how a variety of private organizations, companies, CEOs, of course, left-wing Democrat-type organizations, all united to basically undermine the election and to steal it from Trump. And they did it through, quote-unquote, legal means. And of course, you mentioned they used COVID as a major excuse with the mail-in balloting and voter harvesting and these sorts of things. So the article basically outlines this process and who was involved. And again, they framed it as securing democracy rather than undermining, our democratic institutions and stealing the election from Trump. It was incredibly revealing. I'm sure it's got to be posted somewhere else online, but that's it more or less. It caused headlines at the time because, all the quote unquote conspiracy theorists are reading this in Time Magazine, where this lady is just outlining how all this happened. It was almost as if somebody, a quote-unquote conspiracy theorist themselves wrote it.
Yeah, I remember seeing that now, and I'm going to want to get a copy of that. I'm glad that you reminded me of its existence, John. That's been a little while, but yeah, that's a kind of Orwellian limited hangout in my mind. The Orwellian part of it is they make it sound like something it isn't. They make it sound as if stealing the election is saving the election, which is pure,
well, exactly, yeah, it's
pure
total,
Orwell
inversion, yeah,
yeah,
exactly. How do you pronounce the Secretary of State in Georgia? How do you pronounce his name?
Raffensperger.
Just like his book, Integrity, Election Integrity. It's like the total opposite.
Yeah, integrity counts. Yeah, integrity miscounts the vote, Brad. You know, it's these clowns, these tin soldiers like Raffensperger are just everywhere like cockroaches in the political system. And they're just absolute ladder climbers. They'll step on anybody to get up the proverbial power ladder. All their protestations of integrity to the contrary notwithstanding. And so this, you know, this complete mattoid, this blind idiot, you might say, in the office there, it's just really sad. It speaks to the caliber of people that are in modern political offices. And I don't think the caliber has ever been lower than it is now. There is such a absence of integrity and courage, real integrity and courage, because voter GA, more than any group and longer than any group and more accurately than any group I've seen, is really bringing this out. And, you know, election fraud, and it's important to get some terminology straight. It's actually election fraud or election theft, or you could say vote fraud. If you say voter fraud, what that actually means is people that misrepresent themselves at the polls or vote in more than one precinct. And often that's the fraud committed by the voter themselves. Vote fraud or election fraud or ballot fraud is where the machinery of the elections is stolen or compromised. So just that terminology is very important. That being said, I've also talked with a lot of other people over the years. Vicky Karp of Vote Rescue in Austin, Texas, Jim Condit Jr., who's been involved almost from the beginning in this. He worked on the book Vote Scam, The Stealing of America. And that was a very seminal book early on, right as electronic voting was in its infancy. So what we're seeing in Georgia and many other states from the November 2020 election is by no means anything new, but it's become so brazen, as you mentioned. COVID just seemed to give everyone a green light to just go, you know, go for broke and just go to any measures they had to get Trump out of office and to get this cardboard cutout Joe Biden in there. Just a stooge for the one worlders is all Biden is. That's all he'll ever be. And so it's important now, though, to kind of, now that we've laid a good groundwork, there's an even more recent item from Voter GA. And this headline is dated March 7th. So this is just 3 days ago. Voter GA announced at a press conference on that day, March 7th, 2022, a 15-point analysis, 15-point analysis that documents clear, irrefutable evidence of how the November 2020 Fulton County, Georgia election results were electronically manipulated. Important words, electronically manipulated. That goes back to Jim Condit and others I worked with over the years, John. Anyway, reading on. The analysis was based on a year-long study of ballot images conducted by an expert-laden volunteer research team. The ballot image research was made possible last year when the Georgia legislature, I mentioned this a minute ago, passed Senate Bill 202, which made ballot images public records. And by the way, when I was talking to Garland, John, I said, shouldn't ballot images always be public records? It requires legislation to do that. I was kind of taken aback by that. But going on, the 15-point analysis that can be verified through public ballot images at gaballots.com, that's G-A as in Georgia, gaballots.com, found the following problems in Fulton County. Now buckle your seatbelt here, John. Here we go. 17,724 final certified Fulton votes have no ballot images. All 374,128 in-person ballot images for the original count are missing. All, get that. All 374,128 in-person ballot images for the original count are missing.
Wow. And this is just in this one county.
Yeah, this is in Fulton County, one county in Georgia. I mean, That's two out of the 15. So I hope you're sitting down, and your listeners too. 132,284 mail-in ballot images are missing their authentication files. 4,000 plus tabulator images have impossible duplicate timestamps. 104,994 image files in 1,096 batches have impossible duplicate timestamps. All ballot images, there's that word again, all ballot batches were improperly forced to adjudication to facilitate tampering. 10 ballots, were impossibly adjudicated in 1 minute by one user. 941 image files were backdated prior to adjudication. All 16,034 mail-in image authentication files were added days after scanning. Some 12 tabulators closed 148 early voting polls, masking identity of scanning tabulator. One tabulator serial number impossibly closed two polls in the same overlapping times. One tabulator was never closed and may have added many illegitimate votes. I'm on 13 now. Images in 288 batches have backfiled timestamps out of scanning chronological order. 85 closing tapes for 12,024 election day ballots are unsigned or missing. And that's something I used to do in Michigan. Those closing tapes are very important. All but two tabulator closing tapes for early voting are unsigned. I mean,
wow. Now, just one of those would be enough to throw into question the integrity of the election in that county, right?
Most of them. What Garland told me on the story that already appeared in AFP. Get this, quote, in 70 counties in Georgia, that's not all the counties, but in 70 of those counties in Georgia, 54 of them admitted to the voter GA people that they did not have original ballot images from the November 2020 election, and the other 16 of those 70 counties refused to comply with voter GA's open records request, meaning, get this, that 1.7 million original ballot images have been lost, destroyed, or otherwise unavailable.
Even though you mentioned, and it was a law that they had to keep these records and have these scans available, correct?
They passed a law that made the ballot images public record. Formerly, they were not public record, which again, to me, is outlandish. Every ballot image ever known to mankind should automatically be public record. There should be no legislation required in all 50 states, period. Nothing to discuss.
Yes, I completely agree.
I mean...
I think anybody with any common sense would have to agree with that. That's, you know, should go without saying, and yet it doesn't appear to be happening in most jurisdictions.
Yeah, well, this is part and parcel of what I call the privatization of government. There's so much privatization going on that government itself has almost ceased to be a public enterprise, which would explain its absolute refusal to abide by any requests of people other than you can pay your water bill here, you can pay your tax bill there. But by and large, I've never seen government at all levels more unresponsive to the people than now.
Exactly. You're so right. Unresponsive, unaccountable, no regard for the people that they're supposed to be representing and serving.
Yeah. It's never been worse. And I think this partially explains it. And they don't want any interlopers getting into the system. You know, there's other forms. And, you know, this is all very significant. I probably should just kind of finish here before I get into some other matters. There's so much here, I almost don't know where to begin, but it's also worth mentioning real quick, John, that this implementation partner, along with Salesforce, in this Georgia effort by Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, to privatize the voter registration data, that implementation partner is MTX, a four-year-old company, only 4 years old, from India, not Indiana, India, with no election experience. Their employee list, according to Voter GA, shows only one employee from Georgia. After obtaining a no-bid contract in Texas to develop a contact tracing system for COVID, MTX workers were found to have used their own personal computers and personal email addresses on the project, the contact tracing project. That raised privacy concerns about data security. So you have some fumbling, stumbling, fly-by-night, four-year-old company based in India as the implementation partner for the absolutely biased, lawsuit-ridden Salesforce organization that Raffensperger thinks is the proper recipient of the voter registration list of Georgia in a no-bid contract. And then you add everything else I've said. The most astonishing one, all 374,128 in-person ballot image votes, that's the in-person ballot images for people that voted in person in Fulton County, Georgia, all of them for the original count are missing. Now, it should be game over right there. That's just number two out of these 15.
Right, yeah, exactly. Well, all 15 are very concerning, as I mentioned. You know, any one of those would be, in my mind anyways, enough to call into question the entire process.
Oh, absolutely. And here's the thing. When Voter GA went into this, and I've been following it almost from the beginning, they were winning some court victories under Judge Brian Amero, A-M-E-R-O, and he saw the logic. He saw that they were dotting their I's and crossing their T's and following the law. So he gave them a green light a number of times, but eventually it appeared that he was pressured, probably more than we can imagine. And he kind of put up a roadblock, but Garland, who's the main spokesman for Voter GA, is a very resilient, resourceful person, and he just will not give up. And he just keeps digging and finding this stuff, and it is just criminal that it's happening, that the state of Georgia has gotten away with it this far, and that the main newspapers like the ridiculous Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which isn't worth the paper it's printed on, all it does is, you know, make fun of and lambast and scold and, you know, otherwise belittle and persecute those that raise these issues. So the Fourth Estate, the Orthodox Fourth Estate, is just a dead letter, which is part of the reason this has happened.
Yeah, well, and that's been the media strategy from the beginning, is just to ridicule and lambast anybody that was raising these issues. You know, they were going on and on about how it was, you know, crazy and a conspiracy theory to, you know, to question the results of the election. Meanwhile, these organizations like Voter GA are finding all sorts of very legitimate proofs demonstrating how the elections are fraudulent. And yet, you know, they're getting no media coverage, no legitimate media coverage anyways, at least, in, you know, in the mainstream. I don't even know. I mean, has like Fox News or like any of these more like conservative, like mainstream organizations covered this in any detail?
Not in any detail. And that's an excellent question that I have not had time to answer or look up. More stuff just keeps falling in my lap and I almost can't write the articles fast enough. Excuse me. And but that's an excellent question.
I know like Alex Jones was covering it for a long time following the election, but it seems to fizzle out or seems to have fizzled out because it's not really going anywhere. Nobody's getting any results. I mean, all these voter fraud organizations that were popping up in Arizona and Michigan and, you know, in Georgia demanding recounts and, you know, demanding, you know, just an outright a new election. I mean, there was so much fraud involved. They don't seem to be gaining any traction or really getting anywhere despite all of the legitimate evidence and proofs that they're, you know, coming up with.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's why I put that Voter GA is the most effective and most durable and resilient of all these probes into the election of November 2020. they don't lie down. If they encounter a setback, they figure out a way to deal with it and they keep going. And that's what it's going to take. That's what I've been told by their people, that it's going to take, you know, a long-term, practically institutional effort, not some flash in the pan effort to get this out there. And what's interesting is Voter GA did not start out, John, looking for the kind of evidence that would justify a new election or a recount. They were looking mostly at, were the ballot images the mail-in ballots, which was their big focus at first, were they on the right kind of paper that was the proper stock for a official ballot? Were they folded the way a mail-in ballot would be folded? Were they signed? Did the signature of the voter match the signature on file? They were looking more for those kind of matters. They were not specifically or explicitly looking for the kind of evidence that would actually change the results. But as they kept digging, they came across that evidence, and now we're hearing it now.
Yeah, that's crazy. So they started small, and look where they're at now. They're finding all sorts of information. Well, I'm looking at the website now. I'm also on Garland's Twitter feed, and like you said, I mean, this guy is extremely dedicated to this cause. So I got to tip my hat to him, and you know, I wish everybody involved in this sort of stuff the best of luck. It's definitely going to be an uphill battle, as we've seen. Where do they stand now? I mean, are they actually able to get in front of, like, for example, the Georgia State Legislature or the Senate at the state level to get these issues at least out there and presented in front of these elected representatives?
They had some hand, and I don't know the exact exact extent, but they did have some hand in influencing Senate Bill 202. And engaged in testimony and correspondence with members of the state legislature in Georgia to get the bill passed, to make the original ballot images and all these ballot images public record, which they always should have been, like I said. And that is what has enabled this flood, this tsunami that I just referred to, these 15 points. That's what made that possible. So to the extent that Georgia has listened to these guys in Voter GA, to the extent that the government has given them any heed at all, it has produced this bumper crop of evidence of foul play.
Right. Well, I wish these guys the best of luck. It's not going to be easy for sure.
Yeah. The big three, ES&S out of Omaha, Dominion out of Canada and Colorado, I believe it's Denver, and Hart InterCivic out of Austin, Texas, are the big three electronic vote counting machine operators. They operate those machines. The machines are told how to count the votes with proprietary software that election clerks are not allowed to understand in its complexity. They're only told how to start the car and run the car. They are not to look under the hood. They have representatives of those private companies, technicians for those companies that do the technical work on behalf of the election clerks and the election officials. So what you have is when you go to an election and vote, you are casting a vote in public, but the vote is counted completely out of sight, inside the machine through the proprietary software. And so when you have a secret count, which we do, no matter what they tell you, we have a secret count. When you have that, there's no election result that can be trusted. And that's what Stalin said. He who casts the votes accounts for nothing. He who counts the votes has the power.
Right.
And so the most salient take-home point or takeaway point here is that the election count has been privatized in earnest for about 15 years, let's say, going on 20. There's only a few jurisdictions in New Hampshire and elsewhere that use hand-counted paper ballots and do a public count right at the local precinct level. And what needs to happen is we need to return to mainly a hand-counted paper ballot system where in each voting precinct, the count happens right there after the polls close. You hire people right from that community, not privateers from companies, and you hire them, you do a little background check on them, you pay them a decent wage per hour, and the formula used in New Hampshire is three people for every 50 votes. So for every 50 ballots, in other words, in 50 ballot increments, you have one person read the results. The second person writes the result down manually. The third person looks over the shoulder and makes sure it's done correctly. That is one of the more traditional ways. So you got, again, three people for a given number of ballots. One says, Trump, one vote. The next guy writes it down. The third guy looks over the shoulder and makes sure it was written down correctly. And it's done at the precinct level. And the key is those ballots, the chain of custody of those hand-counted, manually counted ballots never leaves the precinct until that process is done. And it's done on a live camera. It's live streamed on the internet. And everybody can watch the election results being counted in real time. All the people that have been involved in this, John, have told me that's the only way.
Well, and it seems like a very straightforward, common sense way to go about this and to ensure that there is accountability and, you know, just integrity in the whole process. Now it's like we're basically just putting our blind faith and trust in these voting systems and these machines, essentially. And, you know, we just can't trust these people anymore. They've been engaged in so much fraud and corruption over the years. It's, you know, it would be foolish just to simply take their word for it and with the whole process, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And it's important to point out that Voter GA is not, you know, strictly speaking, some pro-Trump organization. They're absolutely unbiased. They are nonpartisan, unlike Salesforce that Raffensperger, you know, is working with. And so this is not some pro-Trump campaign. You know, let the results fall where they may. They just want the real results.
Right, exactly. Well, did you have any other angles you wanted to address with this issue?
I think we've covered the essentials in terms of Georgia taking the lead in this. And I'll mention just in passing that they have gotten some local and regional media coverage. Their press conferences, which are announced at VoterGA.org, are very informative, very well structured, not too long, easy to follow, easy to understand. The media has no excuse. And everything is handled in a timely and professional and nonpartisan manner. But I think that pretty much sums it up. There's so much more that could be said. But, you know, it boils down to make a final kind of overarching statement, it boils down to the dangers of unbridled privatization, you know, farming out the voter registration data, farming out the vote count itself to the big three companies. This is just immensely, immensely irresponsible.
Yes, exactly. That's just what I was thinking. Immensely irresponsible and just totally unnecessary. I mean,
yes,
you know, exactly. We have ways to ensure that there's accountability, you know, and integrity in the whole process, but we're just refusing to follow them.
Yeah, exactly. And so, election theft, it's an industry now, and it's a bitter pill to swallow. It's when you confront it and you look at it, you see that, you know, the last vestiges of the people having any recourse on their government have been or are being stripped away.
Yes, exactly.
The fourth estate's a dead letter already. So, you know, it's very sobering.
Yeah, no, I agree. You know what, I guess I do have one sort of a broader question before we move on to the next topic. How do you think that the election was actually – let's be honest. I don't think there's any doubt that Trump won or would have won if there were – you know, if there was a legitimate vote count in the last election. How do you think that they were able to steal it from him?
It would have been a combination of things. I'm surmising, this is pure speculation, but if I was in their shoes, using the COVID thing, to, number one, to have the mail-in ballot thing inflated way beyond what it should be, you'd start there and you would have mail-in ballots put at these outdoor drop boxes, which were unprecedented. And the question immediately becomes, who would have access, who would have a key to those drop boxes? How could you possibly know that the millions of ballots that were dropped into those outdoor ad hoc drop boxes, how do you know the same ballots that went in are the ballots that came out? Who had the key? Who had access? Who could stop somebody from putting illicit materials inside there that would skew the account along with the so-called legitimate ballots, right there, you have a huge problem. If the wrong people have the keys, they open the box, they take out the legitimately submitted ballots, and they put in a number of illicit ones or fake ones, and which is one reason that Garland and his group wanted to look at the paper stock, look at the way they were folded. Were they folded at all? Did the signatures match, and so on and so forth? And then also you would have the electronic voting machines calibrated in such a way where they would engage in what's known as vote flipping. So every third time, let's say, that a person hits a pro-Trump vote, it flips the vote to Biden on the inside of the machine. All these voting machines, especially the touchscreen ones, are, you know, they're passive instruments. You're hitting that button that says voting for Trump. But does that mean that the machine is recording the vote the way you pressed it, see?
Right, and, yep.
And so right there between the mail-in ballot thing and the proprietary software that tells the machines how to count the vote, you've got more than enough muscle to flip and steal just enough votes to give a plausible victory. But I don't think, and I don't remember all the numbers, but I don't think that Biden's victory was even plausible.
No, exactly. That's what I mean. It was so brazen and in your face and just unbelievable, you know, and especially the way it all went down. I mean, you know, everybody sort of has the same story. You know, everyone went to bed and Trump was ahead in like all the key states, all the key swing states. And then everybody woke up and all of a sudden magically, you know, Biden was ahead. They found all these mail-in ballots and the media was even sort of seeding that narrative leading up to the election. They were saying how, you know, it would look like Trump was going to win on the night of the election, but once the mail-in ballots came in, then Biden would pull ahead. So it was like they were setting the stage for this to you know, seeding this sort of narrative leading up even to the election.
Yes, it's worth noting that in the book Vote Scam, that Jim Conta Jr., a contact of mine, had some hand in researching for the Collier brothers, both of whom have passed away. That book was the seminal sort of standard setting book for the stealing of America. And it talked about the voter news service. And I'm trying to remember the names because the names have been changed. But the voter news service is a syndicate of media outlets that work with the big voting machine companies and government agencies to report the vote on the news to the people. And there's a consortium there. The media are not competing because the mass media cartel is not a conglomeration of competitive enterprises. They are of one view. They are of one mind. They are of one narrative. Fox News's narrative, which seems more conservative, notwithstanding. When it comes to the fundamentals of COVID, when it comes to the fundamentals of the elections, they're of one mind, apart from partisan bias, which doesn't really matter as much as you think it does. And so the Voter News Service, which I believe became the National Election Pool, that's it. Voter News Service became the National Election Pool. The media is involved with the vote counting apparatus behind closed doors and reports those things. And so it sounds, this is not proof, this is speculation, it sounds like the fix was in, based on what you're saying.
Yes, exactly. Well, yeah, it's a very interesting topic, one that's definitely not going away, and you've done a good job covering it. So I hope you keep up the work, and you know, we can learn more about the whole process. I mean, it's really incredible the way they've been able to privatize the election process and just, you know, there's no integrity, there's no accountability, there's no transparency in the process at all anymore, and it's really outrageous.
It is. As an anecdote, I'll offer that right here in my own area, Hidalgo County, Texas, at the March 1st Texas primary, a very early primary here, too early in my opinion, there were some places where you would go vote that had no Republican votes allowed, there were only Democratic voting stations. And of course, it's a primary. Yes, you're nominating people in each party to run in November. So primaries are nomination processes. People forget that. You're not electing anyone. You're nominating people. Americans have got to get that straight for primaries. But that being said, some of my spies in the field were out, and one of them reported back to me that at one voting station, they had 6 Democrat machines and 3 Republican machines, and therefore made the large turnout of Republican voters wait long in line, and some of them were disgusted and went home without voting. And this is the Democratic Party, John, that goes around telling everybody that Republicans are engaged in vote suppression.
Yeah, exactly.
And my own voting precinct, a stone's throw away from my house, I could not go there and vote Republican. There were no Republican votes allowed. Get that?
Unbelievable.
And I'll send you a MP3 if you want to include it in today's show. When you edit it, I have a recording of an election official telling me on the phone and admitting that all this is true.
Interesting. Yeah, you should send that to me.
I will. I will.
Well, we're going to wrap up here in probably the next 10 minutes or so, but I wanted to cover another story that you wrote, and this was actually the front page article in the most recent edition of American Free Press. You talked about this guy, Matthew Perna, I believe is how you pronounce his last name.
Yeah, he's a
37-year-old young man, I believe from Pennsylvania. I don't know exactly all, you know, his background, but he sounds like he traveled quite a bit. He served overseas as a missionary, if I'm not mistaken. And he was involved on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol, involved in the protests, which has been totally dishonestly characterized as an insurrection by the mass media. But he got caught up in this ordeal and was investigated by the federal authorities and ultimately took his own life. I guess it would have been in February.
Yeah, he died February 25th, 2022. And naturally, when you first hear something like this, there's part of you that goes, you know, what a guy, he'd be upset over this. A guy would feel insecure over this, being hounded by federal authorities for taking part January 6, 2021 at the Capitol and all this. But would he take his own life? But Mickey Poletta, who is a monetary reform guy that challenges the mortgage foreclosure racket, a longtime contact of mine. It's his brother, Mark Poletta, in northwestern Pennsylvania, that lived right down the street from Matt Perna, 37-year-old Matt Perna. And so I had a very credible source that saw this guy every day and saw the open casket. This really happened. And, at first it sounded almost like an urban legend. But at any rate, yeah, Matthew Lawrence Perna, who attended the protest January 6, 2021, has taken his own life. And even the obituary that was published in the Sharon Herald, Sharon, Pennsylvania being the town he lived near, and posted on the website of the funeral home, that obituary said Perna died February 25, 2022 of a broken heart. His community, which he loved, his country, and the justice system killed his spirit and his zest for life. Matt was an amazing man. And it goes on to say that he was hounded by federal authorities to confess about his alleged involvement in what the media and the Democratic Party are calling the QAnon insurrection of January 6th at the Capitol.
Yeah, but, exactly.
But I guess that according to Mark Poletta, again, who lived near him and, you know, would have a snack with him and, you know, visit with him for long periods of time. Matt was increasingly concerned about his country. He did happen to be pro-Trump. He went to the rally, which was a Stop the Steal rally. Now, this ties into the elections that we were just talking about, the election theft. It was actually a rally and a protest, not an insurrection, of mainly Trump supporters who went to the Capitol January 6, 2021 to protest what they saw as a rigged and stolen election. But instead, the media says that everybody there, including Matt Perna, is there to overturn Congress certifying the election rather than the truth. They're not there to overturn the election. They're there to protest the fact that they felt the election had already been overturned in the ways we just got done describing in the first part of today's show, John. And so, once again, total inversion of the narrative by the mass media cartel. And FBI agents, according to what I was able to ascertain, to the best of my understanding, threatened Matt Perna with 20 years in prison and apparently conveyed the impression that they could make such a draconian sentence stick. I'm reading from my story in the recent AFP. Unless Perna would divulge details about his friends, in other words, rat him out, who were with him that day on Capitol Hill. And as Mark Pauletta explained to me, Matt told the FBI agents, we were not part of the QAnon. We were just there as witnesses. We were pushed aside, we were pushed inside the Capitol. An actual policeman opened the door for us. It was wide open and unlocked, and he let us in.
Yeah, there was all sorts of people saying that.
And Matt did not break anything. Matt did not break anything. No vandalism. He didn't do anything, as Mark Pauletta told me. He observed the protest. He took video. Period. That's it.
Yeah. Well, it's really outrageous. I mean, they have been hounding all of these people since the day this happened. You know, I mean, they called it the largest investigation in the history of the FBI. I mean, and think about the double standards on display when you look at all of 2020 and even before that, all of these, you know, BLM and Antifa terrorists who are out like engaging in legitimate violence and vandalism and, you know, damage to public property and attacking people. And these people aren't even investigated, you know, let alone prosecuted for their crimes. So, the double standards are just so outrageous, and it shows that the rule of law itself has been politicized, obviously, but also weaponized against, you know, conservative, right-wing, populist dissidents.
Right. Anybody that fits in any or all of those descriptions, no matter how oblique the comparison or no matter how, you know, distant you might be from those things. In other words, anybody even vaguely connected to those ideas, populism, conservatism, constitutionality, is considered a quasi-terrorist, kind of an unindicted felon in this society of ours. And just to sum this up, Mark Pauletta went on to say, they kept threatening Perna with 20 years and harassed that kid, called him every other day. They wanted to know about the QAnon people. They ruined his life. Pelosi and her orders to the Justice Department killed that kid. That's Perna. Killed that kid, as Mark Pauletta told me. They took his will to fight and his will to live away from him. And if you read the background on him, you see he was an extraordinary young man, a real American. He used to come over and sit on my porch even before January 6th, and we'd talk mainly about the government. He had Trump flags in his front yard, and he had an American flag upside down. This is Matt Perna. He said the government was upside down, and they were not treating people fairly. They were doing all the wrong things, all the wrong programs for all the wrong reasons. And they wanted to know everything about who went with Perna and how they got there. What marching orders did they have? Was Matt a member of QAnon? Everything, Pauletta told AFP. They tormented that kid. He would not tell them anything, and he would not plead guilty.
Well, was he ever actually jailed? I mean, I know he was under investigation and constantly hounded by these people, but did he ever actually see the inside of a jail cell like a lot of these other people?
There was a day when six cop cars showed up and blocked his driveway as Mark Pauletta, nearby two houses down at the corner, was home, and he kept watching. And within a half hour, they brought him out in handcuffs. So at the very least, he was taken downtown, as it were.
Right, for questioning or whatever. Yeah. Yeah, they have really used the full weight of the justice system against a lot of these people that participated in this protest. That's exactly what it was—a protest, including a lot of the guys associated with the Oath Keepers. I just put together a story the other day, earlier this week, that's published on American Free Press's website. Highlighting and detailing the plea deal that one of the leaders of the Alabama chapter of the Oath Keepers entered into with federal prosecutors. He basically is agreeing to plead guilty to one count of a seditious conspiracy and one count of obstructing an official proceeding. And there's a slew of charges that a lot of these Oathkeeper guys were facing. And you know, he agreed to two of them, or pled guilty to two of them. And he's going to be used as basically, you know, an informant against these other Oathkeepers involved in this suit here. And it's, you know, again, it just shows like these people are being pressured. You know, it's just really, really an unfair situation. And, you know, the media has played a key role. This has, you know, been the narrative ever since January 6th is, you know, this idea that, like, domestic extremists are the greatest threat to the homeland. This is something that we've seen the Biden administration really run with. And, you know, it any objective person has got to view this as just an outright attack on any sort of right-wing, populist, America First political dissent.
Yeah, I'm not altogether sold on Oathkeepers, just for the record. I think there's some machinations there that need further investigation, just to put it gingerly.
Sure,
Stuart Rhodes, to me, I think he needs to be asked a lot of questions. It's almost as if they're intentionally playing into the hands of the feds in order to discredit the rest of the movement.
Sure, exactly.
I'll just call that an allegation, and I'm not saying that every Oathkeeper is that way or necessarily that Stuart Rhodes is that way, but it smells like that. And enough said, I'll be, you know, gingerly about it, but there's a lot of questions that need to be asked, because it's not hard to understand how a certain group could sort of intentionally skew things in order to bring opprobrium on the rest of the groups. That being said, a lot of the people that went there January 6th went there for reasons just like Matt Perna, just to be an American citizen speaking out, exercising their First Amendment rights. And that's part and parcel of another thing I've been writing about in a series, and I won't cover this in detail. We did enough in my election fraud series, but a more formal series I began writing, John, recently about political prisoners in America. And part two of that series appeared in this most recent AFP. About David Hinkson, and I'm just going to give it the highlights. Having died in prison from cancer, and he was allowed to waste away. And Judge Richard C. Tallman, T-A-L-L-M-A-N, just like it sounds, Tallman, twice denied request to free David Hinkson under established compassionate release provisions. In other words, it wasn't even enough that he had terminal cancer to let him out. They kept him in prison anyway. And, I mean, you know, that's just outright cruelty. And cruel and unusual punishment is unconstitutional.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I, and this is, again, something that most people don't know about. I know you cited there's a website that follows a lot of these political prisoners. And, I mean, you can check it out. There's a lot of people facing these sorts of circumstances. And it's something that really doesn't get enough coverage, I think.
Oh, absolutely, it does not. And David Hinkson, the short version is he was falsely accused by a perjuring witness of trying to pay that witness $10,000. Wait a minute, let me get this straight. What led to Hinkson's imprisonment was Swisher, the perjuring witness, his claim that Hinkson offered Swisher $10,000 to kill federal judges. Elvin Joe Swisher, who I believe was in the military at one time and had a lot of respect in the local community, but he ended up perjuring himself under another in another case, and actually was in prison for perjury. And Swisher passed away in June of 2020. So Hinkson, ever since 2005, was in the CMU prisons, which are the most brutal of the federal prisons. One is in Terre Haute, Indiana. Another is in Marion, Illinois. I've been near the one in Marion. Let me tell you, you would not want to be there. And so David Hinkson, who was a businessman and he had a radio show, he developed some health supplements successfully, etc., and an interesting energy generation motor called the Galt, named for John Galt in Ayn Rand's novel Atlas Shrugged. A very innovative energy generation motor, get that, all these things. So he was talented, a good technician, a good businessman, a good radio guy, was not allowed out of jail, even though he had terminal cancer. He was in there since 2005 on trumped up charges by a perjured witness. And so there you have it. And he is not the only of these political prisoners of in America to die in prison. Another was Edgar Steele, that I'll soon be covering in AFP. And I'll be covering many other political prisoners. This is an ongoing series. And some who have died, some who got out and were freed, some that are still in prison, etc. So I would be amiss, though, John, not to mention a really important part of this. And you might recall an article I had in recently about P.F. Laser. He's a longtime incarcerated political prisoner for exercising his First and Second Amendment rights. And he has been imprisoned unjustly and falsely ever since 1983. Under the rules, he should have been out in May of 1992. Get that? But he's been kept over for, you know, prison regulation violations and all sorts of petty things. The Board of Parole hearings in California, he's a prisoner at Salinas Valley State Prison in California near Soledad. The parole board, the Board of Parole hearings, is absolutely corrupt and compromised. They constantly, every 3 or 4 years, send him back to the California gulag. I call it the Golden State Gulag. And they won't let him out. And he's in a race against time, John, because he says he has extreme personal chemical sensitivities. And if a anticipated mandatory COVID jab for the California prison population, if that comes down the pike, he feels that they'll force him to take it, despite his religious objections that are on record, and that it would probably kill him. And he is urging listeners and readers to write to him, to write and contact the Office of the Inspector General and the DA. And if I may, John, to conclude today's show, I'll give that information.
Yes, please. Yeah.
Okay. First of all, the easiest way to write to the Office of Inspector General of the California Correction System is go to the website oig.ca.gov/connect. That's OIG as in Office of Inspector General, .ca as in California, .gov/connect. And you'll see where you can write in complaints or just write in general public input. I would suggest writing in both fields, in both internet fields, and inputting, you know, information like PF Laser, PF like Paul Frank, that's not his name, but PF Laser is L like Larry, A Z like Zebra, O R, PF Laser, that he's been unjustly imprisoned. He should have been let out long ago. The Board of Parole hearings has been unfair to him, things like that. They've been breaking the rules where unless the and California law says that unless a prisoner is in there for a particularly heinous crime, and unless that prisoner can be deemed to be a extreme risk to society if let out, like one of the Manson gang or something, unless those two criteria can be met, then that prisoner under state law should be let out. And that needs to be really emphasized among people that might write to these agencies to call for Laser being freed. And another one is the extremely unfair DA that keeps him there. The DA, Jeffrey Rosen, sends a representative to the Board of Parole hearings, and that representative has constantly ruled against Laser getting out, even though Laser is a model prisoner. He has gotten into calling out the prison for breaching its own rules for you know, serving bad food, not abiding by their own regulations, mistreating prisoners. There is a way for prisoners to report that. He's been doing that, and yet they punish him for it. That's where his First Amendment rights have been abridged. His Second Amendment rights were abridged when he shot someone in self-defense in 1983, but they sent him down the river, put him in prison for second-degree murder in what was clearly self-defense. And he was denied a real trial. No real evidence in his defense was even admitted, John. But people can write to the district attorney, Jeff Rosen, at 408, excuse me, call him, call him at 408-299-3099. Once again, 408-299-3099. That's Jeff Rosen, R-O-S like Sam, E-N, District Attorney of Santa Clara County, California. His email is jrosen, as in Jeff Rosen, jrosen@dao, that's like dog, apple, Oliver, .sccgov.org. So there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, no, very good. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. And thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. We will go ahead and wrap up for this edition. And as we do that, I would just like to encourage everybody to go out and subscribe to American Free Press. The website is AmericanFreePress.net, and there is a subscription page where you can get a digital subscription, which I believe is only $25 for the full year, or you can get the actual print edition. I've always preferred a print publication myself. It's something that is you don't really find often anymore, but you know, I certainly appreciate an actual print physical copy of the newspaper. So I would encourage people to subscribe to the paper and to support our efforts. And yeah, thanks, Mark. I appreciate it. We'll definitely do this again soon.
Sounds good, John. I'll give you updates on the election stuff. And I'll just throw in a real quick writing address for Laser. You can also write to Overland Mail, Office of Inspector General, Intake Unit, 10111 Old Placerville Road, Placerville, Old Placerville Road, Suite 110, Sacramento, California, 95827, if you want to send hard copy mail to Free Laser. So there you go.
All right, very good. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.